Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is the hour we get to spend together and figure out what happened this week, what mattered, what does it all mean. And my guest this time around, Essex Porter, reporter at Cairo 7 News. Welcome back, Essex.
Good to be back.
Erica C. Barnett covers the city at thecisforcrank.com. Welcome back, Erica.
Thanks, Bill.
Nice to see you. Briar Dudley, Seattle Times editorial board. Good to see you again. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, right now, it was just a few hours ago that hundreds of volunteers crisscrossed King County streets and parks and bridges and doorways, counting the number of people spending the night outside. And the head of the agency that runs this annual count, Kira Zylstra, says we're not going to know the final number for a few months. It's probably going to underrepresent the problem, but it's still useful.
I think it's important that we all have an understanding of what the problem really looks like, of the people that are out there needing our support, so that we can respond in really relevant ways. The more that we know about those that are in need, the better and more meaningfully we can respond.
Last year's count found more than 11,000 people outside, and of course that's not all that homelessness encompasses. We're not going to get this year's number till maybe May or June. Briar Dudley from the Seattle Times, how meaningful will that number be?
Well, it's important. You know, they've changed the methodology over the last few years, so it's getting, you know, we have to be careful that we're doing apples to apples comparisons to see what's going on. Our editorial board participated in the one night count a couple of years ago, and it was a fantastic thing to do.
How do you mean participated? You were out there with flashlights?
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What was that like?
It was great. It was a really it's a tragedy that we're all addressing and dealing with every day, but that particular event has a really positive vibe, and it gets a lot of people out, and it shows the depth of compassion that people have and enthusiasm to address this problem. So I think that's great. On the other side, you know, when I was doing it, some of the methodology was a little bit not as good. We're a city that does really well at measuring and counting things digitally, and, you know, we're doing this count, and they had, for instance, every car was supposed to be two people. And I could see inside a car and I'd see one person and they'd say, well, sorry, our protocol is two people per car. So
why is that? Because you might not see someone. So they're kind of averaging out somehow?
They've improved it since then. But, the numbers are good. We need to keep, get as much data as we can on this problem. And that's been one of the problems that the consultants for the city and King County have said is you really need to improve your data collection to figure out what's going on, the scope of the problem, to improve the management of the system. And, every bit of data helps. There are other things. The county is improving its entry system, basically, its measuring system. So it'll all.
And when they measure that final number, I finally want to know how meaningful do you think that number is going to be?
I don't know. I'd say 6 on a scale of 10, but I think it's important to compare year to year and see trends. Yeah. We've expanded the geographic scope of the one night count over the last few years too. So we just need to be careful with these numbers to be sure we're, like I said, apples to apples.
Essex, what's going to flow from that tally, that homeless tally? What comes of it?
Well, one of the things, of course, that comes from it is it gives leaders an idea of then how much money they have to try to ask people for to address the problem. It gives them an idea of some of the multiple facets. Who is homeless is as important as how many people are homeless, and how people got homeless, became homeless, is as important as how many people. So, we're still a region that is developing the strategy.
They follow up with interviews, right?
I don't know
more about these people.
That's right, yeah. They do.
And what, Erica, what do you think is most important about this annual count?
I think it's useful for getting a sense of trends, and the trend in recent years has been, up, up, up. Which wouldn't surprise anybody who lives in the city of Seattle in particular. You can see the trend, just on an anecdotal basis, just walking through the streets of downtown. So I think it's useful in that sense. I think that, one of the things that came out of last year's count, which included, if you include both the one night count and just the overall count of all the people who are homeless in King County and the region, it's going up. It's almost 30,000. One thing that struck me in those numbers was that the number of people who disappear from homelessness are largely unaccounted for. So they measure the number of people who left homelessness and the number of people who came into homelessness. But there's a huge chunk of those that we don't actually know where they went. They could have gone to jail, which is counted as not being homeless anymore. They could have gone to another city. They could still be homeless but not be in the system. So, I mean, there is some real data collection issue that there are quite a few issues that we still haven't addressed with in terms of just getting good data on these folks and who they are and why they became homeless in the first place.
I'm feeling bad about saying six. I should say seven. I think it was a great effort, and don't mean to diminish that effort. And I'm thrilled people are participating in that. So,
well, Breyer, if the number goes up as is, I think, widely expected, do you think that the voters will take away the message that the problem keeps it growing faster than we can address it? We need to do more. We need to spend more. Or would the reaction be, well, what we're doing is, look, all the money we're throwing at homelessness and it's not working?
Well, you'll probably get both answers depending on who you ask.
Yeah.
You know,
overall, what in your reporting, you know, you said you're covering this. What sense are you getting in King County?
Well, I think that people are feeling pushed on how much they've been paying to, you know, contributing to this problem, and they want to see some measurable results. You know, people do care here. It's an incredibly compassionate place, and we're all doing what we can and contributing. But at some point, you know, it's up to about $200 million a year, according to our reporting at the Times, that's spent in King County on a so we need to see some progress there. And, you know, last year, Dow Constantine and former Mayor Ed Murray kind of hatched a plan to have a sales tax increase put on the ballot this year in 2018, raise about $470 million or something. It's probably going to be higher because the sales tax revenue is higher. So, you know, we're approaching, you know, talking about another $500 million infusion into this. And I think that's going to be a real hard sell.
But how is that plan really still alive? I thought that plan had pretty much gone by the wayside, especially after Ed Murray was not able to run for re-election and ultimately resigned.
Well, there are a couple different tax things. First, Ed proposed a property tax increase with Nick Hanauer, and that got shot down real fast. And so then Ed and Dow got together and thought, well, maybe we should make it more regional. And they came up with the regional tax plan. Dow was asked about this when he announced his one table round table thing. And he acknowledged that, yeah, that's still on the table. And that's part of the reason that he's formed this task force is to, you know, it's the usual approach we have on these things is you form a task force, you build some support before you pop the levy out. And so that's why the data question is such a good one, Bill, because we've got to, people really want to get some crisper numbers around this and be able to know for sure what's going on.
I think that, you know, I actually agree with you, Breyer, believe it or not, on the need for this task force or whether it's really needed. I do think it's important that they're taking a regional approach. I think that is something that we've paid a lot of lip service to before but haven't really done. But this task force is a 75-member group of people that, it's one of the largest, it feels like these task forces are getting larger and larger and larger with every iteration, you know, on every issue. And I do think they're going to come up with a tax proposal at the end of the day. And I think, you know, their stated goal is to look at how to approach the root causes of homelessness. So they've identified some root causes finally. So we're past the stage of figuring out what causes people to become homeless. But now they're looking at solutions. And I think the solutions are already available. I don't think that we need a 75-member task force to meet for however many months to figure out that we need to fund addiction treatment, we need to fund behavioral health, we need to fund housing most of all, because housing is extremely expensive in the Seattle and Puget Sound region. And we need to do these things in a way that is cost efficient, but it will also cost money. And I was looking up the results of the housing levy a couple years ago, and I have not been able to find the exact percentage, but I know that it passed overwhelmingly. It was $290 million, which was more than we've ever funded housing with before, but we're going to need a lot more. I was sitting at the Progressive Revenue Tax Force that the City Council formed the other day, and they were saying that the need is something like $3.2 billion in the next 10 years. So it's a costly problem because it has to do with housing, and housing is extremely expensive for low-income people.
I actually think we should decouple the housing topic a little bit from homelessness, because affordability in Seattle is a problem. It will always be a problem, and it's frankly never going to be completely solved. Look at any other big global city. It's not affordable, and that's you can throw hundreds of millions of dollars a year at that, and we will never be back to where we were in 1972 on affordability. But the homelessness thing needs a more immediate and effective response. And, you know, it's largely an issue of addiction. There's a behavioral health, mental health issue there that's pretty substantial. And, you know, we can really hit those things hard. And we can also keep working on affordability on the side. But it kind of gets all mushed together. And I think that's for political reasons, because the developer community is so strong around here and kind of pulls the strings at City Hall and King County Courthouse.
But is it really possible to decouple them in that way? Because once you get somebody well, and once they're able to get some kind of employment, they still need a place to live.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's something we should be talking about. When the city did a real deep dive survey last year on homeless, where they actually went out and sent people to go, you know, just kind of a higher grades count in time. I think it was like 11% of the people who were homeless said it was because of rent increases and things like that. So, you know, what percentage of the homeless problem is due to rent increases? That's the best number we have right now. And the greater problem from that survey was mental health and addiction.
Well, I think we're not looking at rent increases. I mean, the problem of affordability is different for people at different levels of the spectrum of income. So if you're talking about people making between nothing and, say, poverty level or 30% of area median, you're talking about a completely different problem than just rent increases. You're talking about the need for an actual subsidy for those people to be able to afford a place to live. Whereas if you're talking about someone like me, you know, or someone making a little bit less than me, say, 50 to 80% of income, that might be a problem of rent increases. And it might be a matter of giving people a voucher for, you know, for temporary help, for example. I mean, there are different problems, and some of them do deal directly with homelessness. I mean, if you're making nothing, you can't afford to pay anything for a place to live.
Should we pause there on, sure. Okay, on the homeless count? This is, again, just one aspect of homelessness. This is a physical count of people living outside, and this happened just in the last few hours. There are people in shelters. There are people who are moving from place to place, staying with friends. But this is one way that King County gets a snapshot of the homelessness situation, and the tally will come out. Why so many months away? Late May, early June.
That's a great
question.
It takes
so long.
I asked this last year, and the only response I really got is, "Well, it just takes as long as it takes. We need to, you know, do disaggregation and look at the numbers more closely and do a data analysis." But I'm not really sure. This is a new phenomenon. It used to come out much more quickly when the Coalition on Homelessness was doing it. Now it's a company out of California.
Erica C. Barnett, C is for Crank.com. We have Briar Dudley here, Seattle Times editorial board, Cairo 7 news reporter Essex Porter, and we're going to come right back and talk about what we've learned about Amtrak and, speaking of trains, the car tab tax hit that Sound Transit might take. That might be a rebate for you, depending on where you stand. Stay tuned to the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. We're on Twitter right now, at KUOW. Essex Porter, Erica C. Barnett, Briar Dudley. I'm Bill Radke. I didn't see the sign. I've told a trooper that before. Sorry, officer, I didn't notice the sign, but I'm not an Amtrak engineer. This week, the National Transportation Safety Board released an interview with the engineer on the Amtrak train that derailed near Tacoma last month. It killed three people. It hurt dozens of people. And this engineer actually told the investigators he didn't see or didn't recognize the signposts telling him to slow down before that sharp curve. So what happened is the train was heading south at somewhere around 80 miles an hour. The engineer says he saw the milepost that said that big curve across the freeway was coming in about 4 miles. He was planning to slow down about a mile before the curve, except he didn't see that mile before the curve milepost. He says he didn't see the reduced speed limit sign. He did see the marker that comes right before the curve, but he thought that was a different marker. I mean, I can still not really understand this, and I read the Seattle Times article 5 times. I mean, this was his, not that the article was incomprehensible, but this was his job, to slow down at the curve that he says that he knew was coming soon. How did you react?
Well, one of the things I have to wonder is how this particular engineer was selected for the route. The article also says that he had just one southbound trip before taking this inaugural run.
Yes, this is a brand new run that used to go along the Sound, but they moved it inland to save time. So this was the first run, and this was the southbound trip that he only made once before.
Engineers had been trained, but he had only made this run once.
Yeah.
Was there perhaps an engineer who had made it multiple times southbound who might have had a better chance to have memorized where the slowdown points are?
Or why wasn't he better trained? I mean, that was the question that came up in my mind when I was reading the story. He'd only run it once. That seems totally inadequate. And my other question was, well, what is the problem with implementing this positive train control technology, mm-hmm. which would, as I understand it, would have automatically started the slowdown process if he hadn't taken this action? So the Seattle Times story says that this has been around since the 1970s. So I'm really curious.
The railroads in general, mm-hmm. believe it's really expensive. Amtrak actually is one of the railroads that has actually pushed for it, but it is the freight railroads who really control and run the railroads in this country. They've always been able to get delays out of Congress because it is so expensive. I think at even one point they threatened basically to shut down the freight system if they had to implement it so quickly. So at least there are not likely to be any more delays. It should be implemented by the end of this year. One of the questions is, why didn't Amtrak and the Washington State Department of Transportation wait until it had been implemented on Amtrak on this route before going ahead?
That is a big question. I mean, well, the human error is obviously going to happen. People can make mistakes all the time driving these kind of things. This is a terrible tragedy. I mean, terrible for the guy, terrible for everybody. You know, it is very surprising, though. You know, you've got a route with you're going to be going 80 miles an hour and then have to dramatically slow down for a really fairly tight S curve. You would think that you would be anticipating that big curve kink in the middle of the track along the way.
And even without the automatic slowdown that hasn't come along yet, I mean, I drive along. I have a GPS on my little phone cradle. You know, I can see. I don't have to rely on seeing signs before I have to slow down with dozens of people's lives in my hands. I can see myself blinking on the screen. I can't fathom it.
Well, maybe it's because our train system is underfunded in this country. I mean, based on what Essex is describing, and it's just based on having read about this over the years, I mean, it seems like we aren't funding the kind of safety measures that would implement, say, a GPS-type system or something that would automatically kick in when the engineer failed to act.
Two thoughts on this. The system truly is underfunded. You know, this route is only 10 minutes faster than the route that goes around the Sound. The main reason they're doing it is because the route that goes around the Sound is subject to mudslides. And when you have a mudslide, the rule is you can't run a passenger train for 48 hours, even though you might be able to run freight.
Thank you.
So it's more reliable to go the new route. And a train that's 80 miles an hour, I haven't had a chance to ride the trains in Europe, but I have a feeling 80 miles an hour is not a high-speed train in Europe or Japan or China.
Well, you know, yes, the trains are overall underfunded in America, but Sound Transit, which is the operator of this stretch of track, is extraordinarily well-funded, and Burlington Northern is doing really well. And, you know, Warren Buffett, I was doing okay. So I think that the trains can't afford it argument is a little weak in this case. And, you know, Sound Transit told me when the thing happened that, yeah, the system is pretty much installed right now. It's just a matter of implementing it. It's pretty complex because it's not just like, a dash camera you put in, you turn on the switch or anything like that. It has to coordinate with the sensors and the track and satellites and GPS and blah, blah, blah. So it's complicated. But the system was there and it was going to be live like in the first quarter or second quarter this year. So that is a great question about why didn't they wait? You know, what was the rush to flip it over to this track? It seemed like there was some kind of symbolism that they were trying to achieve to show progress at a certain calendar time. I don't know. Who knows?
And there's also been reporting that either federal money was at stake or a promise to the federal government was at stake that the run really needed to be starting this quarter. But when I've done the reporting on it, I've never really gotten quite a clear answer as to whether somehow federal money would have been taken away if they had waited until later in 2018 to also implement positive train control.
The NTSB is leading the investigation on it. The NTSB has been banging the table saying trains need this positive train control for a long time. So, and but they're looking for the cause of the specific accident, and I think the cause will probably come down to human error. There will be other discussions that we ought to have locally, regionally, about, you know, priorities and why we did this, when, and, you know, what decisions were made to get the train there before that system was in, and also, you know, how much are we going to rush ahead next time before the safety equipment is in place? And I, unfortunately, some of that stuff might come out through lawsuits, because we're already starting to see lawsuits here.
Well, the NTSB is going to be looking into how this engineer was trained, among other things we talked about. They want to know, was he training in the daytime, in the nighttime, in a group, individually? Where were the engineers in the front, in the rear? All these questions about what is adequate training in this case. Some Amtrak workers have raised concerns that they didn't feel adequately trained. So we'll learn more about that. I also want to talk about cars for a moment, because this week the State House of Representatives passed a bill to cut your car tab taxes, which would cost Sound Transit billions of dollars. So the background, Sound Transit's been calculating your car tab tax by overestimating how much your car is worth, especially newer cars. Taxpayers found out about that and got mad, so this bill would reduce the tax and give you a rebate for the overcharge, except Sound Transit was going to use that money to build light rail from Tacoma to Everett, still is. The bill's going to cost them directly $780 million over 11 years. Sound Transit says they would then have to borrow more money plus interest, and that would cost more than $2 billion. So is there any chance Sound Transit would just have to build less light rail? What do we think is going to happen with this?
I think it's working out just fine. I think that it's not endangering light rail. I think that's a bit overstated. And $70 million a year for Sound Transit should be absorbable. Yes, it's not.
What do you mean absorbable? It's just fat in their budget, or it's, they're saying they have to borrow, they still got the project that the voters approved, so they're either going to, now they're going to have to borrow the money at interest. What do you think?
Well, perhaps. Well, let's see. You know, let's see how their revenues are doing. Most of their revenue comes from sales tax. Sales tax has been coming in higher in Washington State, much higher than, you know, people expect. The state of Washington's had a much higher forecast for revenue. We haven't heard that from Sound Transit yet. How much of their, you know, where are they as far as their forecasted budget and what's actually coming in? You know, somebody told me, I haven't followed it, tracked it down, somebody told me that Sound Transit's expecting to be way high on their sales tax revenue. Maybe it's a wash for them. Well, we have to see there. But, you know, the system is not so brittle that it can't absorb a little change. Actually, as we said in the editorial the other day about this, Sound Transit, to their credit, has built a pretty resilient financial plan with multiple revenue streams, you know, lots of contingency fees and things, lots of contingencies set aside and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a $70 billion plus project over almost a century, and it's going to have little adjustments, and it doesn't mean that things are going to go to hell in a handbasket.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting to hear an editorial board member of the Seattle Times talking about, let's just rely on contingencies, because that seems like a high-risk proposition to me that, you know, that the newspaper does not typically adopt with other projects.
What would be the high risk?
Well, the high risk is assuming that sales tax revenues are going to continue coming in high, which is not historically the case when you have downturns, which are historically inevitable. So that's a risk. Another risk is the fact that if we do continue to have a boom and if we do continue to have a hot economy, the problem is that makes everything more expensive. It makes construction more expensive. It makes the cost of steel and concrete more expensive. We saw that in light rail to Linwood, which was, I believe, $510 million over budget. That was just because costs increased. So when you say that there's plenty of contingency built in, I mean, is there $500 million for each individual stretch built in? I don't think so. And I think depriving Sound Transit of $2 billion, $2.3 billion in revenues is going to have an impact, even if they figure out a way to make up that money. And one of the things they've talked about doing is taking away the $500 million that Sound Transit pledged for education in the Puget Sound region. Then there's going to be impacts in other areas. So
what
now,
kind of education?
It's education related projects for kids that are less privileged. So one of the possibilities was, you know, Jessen Farrell, former state legislator, talked about funding childcare, funding affordable housing near schools, and, you know, just other projects that.
How is that tied to Sound Transit?
It was built into the original legislation that passed.
But the projects wouldn't be having anything to do with...
No, not directly.
Okay, got it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that transit advocates have to remember, though, is they do need public support. And the only initiative that's ever been on the ballot in modern times without paid signature gatherers was Initiative 695, the first $30 car tab fee initiative that Tim Eyman did. It didn't need paid signature gatherers because people were so angry at the way that their cars were overvalued at that time and how much they had to pay and how much of the money went for things that had nothing to do with transportation. So transit advocates who are trying to hold on to this money and may have many good arguments.
Who originally opposed that money, by the way. This was what they got it spent for, the $500 million, what they got.
Oh, no, I'm not speaking specifically about the education money in this case. I'm speaking specifically about the fact that the legislature seems poised to roll back some of the valuations on cars because people are upset that cars are being overvalued. That's not in dispute. The thing is that to maintain the system's political viability, transit advocates may have to accept less money because otherwise people are too angry to see the benefits. And that's exactly what happened when Initiative 695 got on the ballot without any paid signature gatherers.
And maybe this is a messaging problem for transit advocates. I don't know. But the overvaluation wasn't done by Sound Transit. It was done by the legislature. It was done in the 1990s. And it's based on a 1999 schedule for how much your car is worth. So, you know, if you want to point the finger at anybody, point it at legislators who authorized the schedule, which is in the law now, and don't point it at Sound Transit. But again, I mean, I agree with you, Essex. It is certainly more of a messaging issue and more of a, you know, how angry are voters going to be about this issue than it is really a funding issue or a blame issue at this point.
I think legislators are concerned about that. I think that there's a broad feeling in the legislature, as we saw from this thing passing out of the House, that they kind of screwed up a little bit with the Sound Transit when they authorized Sound Transit's financing. And they want to fix it. They want to make it right. It's the biggest investment, you know, Washington State will probably ever make. It's enormous. It's going to go on for generations. And it's ST3, the third phase, is just starting. And why start it out with half the population in this taxing district cheesed off about it and thinking it's broken and that they were bamboozled? And the legislators, they're still feeling burned because they thought they were authorizing a $15 billion revenue package for Sound Transit. And then Sound Transit turned around and, you know, increased that to $54
billion.
Lawmakers
are feeling burned because they didn't read the fine print closely enough. Absolutely. There are two valuation schedules that the legislature has passed. Sound Transit used the first one. They were open about it. Even one state senator tried to get other senators to vote against it, but those senators said, not a problem. And the Senate, with knowledge of forethought, passed the valuation schedule that Sound Transit is using, even though there is a newer, more fairer valuation schedule that they could have insisted on.
Yeah, they're gonna tweak this thing as it goes along. I mean, that's just the way something like this works. It's horribly complex. It's a big octopus with. And the arms are going to move a little bit here and there. You know, it's just that it is. It's not chiseled in stone.
I would question a little bit how much, and I mean, I'd love to see some accurate polling on this, but I would question whether it's half the voters are cheesed off about this, because you're talking about people who own cars that are 10 years old or newer. So that's the population that currently says that their cars are being overvalued or whose cars are being overvalued.
Let's call them the cheesed off population.
But we don't know of that population, you know, how many are saying, you know what, it's not worth it to me to pay $40 more a year to have transit for generations.
True.
Personally, if I can't afford a new car, but if I could, I would be happy to pay the additional tax. I mean, that's because I feel like that's a good investment in the region beyond my generation. And it's worth it to me. But I would like to know how true that sentiment is and how much of it is being ginned up by the Seattle Times, for example, by
Breyer, are you ginning something
by
up?
By a few very vocal advocates.
Erica C. Barnett, the C is not for cheesed off. but Breyer Dudley?
I just pulled the half of the population thing out of my ear. I'll say that. But the House busted out with a majority. So, you know, the perception is, you know, the majority of our state representatives in the House think that there's a problem. That
it passed. Yeah, it passed the State House of Representatives. It'll go to the Senate, and we'll see whether this car tab rollback will go through and how that might affect sound transit.
The Senate, I might say, may insist on finding a way to put some of that money back to sound transit in a different way. They may look to backfill some of that money.
Uh-huh. Okay. So we'll watch that happen. The session ends when? The regular session?
First or second week of March.
March, okay. Yeah. All right. So this is all happening along with whatever else they have going on in Olympia. So we'll follow that for you. I want to talk about this week Amazon opening this store in Belltown, Seattle neighborhood, where you walk in and swipe your phone and pick up your groceries and walk out. No checkout lines, no scanning your items, almost no employees there. There are some, though. Someone has to stock those shelves, et cetera. But it's just sensors and cameras. I talked to GeekWire's Todd Bishop, who went and bought himself some juice and a salad.
I grabbed one type of salad and then, held it close to me and then put it back and then grabbed the other one right on top of it. And I walked out and they send a receipt to the app and they knew which salad I had actually taken out. It tracked it precisely.
Amazon Go is the name of the store. And Erica C. is still considering Amazon Go. You sound ambivalent, Erica.
I'm ambivalent because I don't need companies tracking me even more and advertising to me even more online. I'm tired of, looking at a rug that a friend sent me to look at and evaluate and having to deal with rug advertisements for the next 10 years.
I think we've all experienced that. I searched one time. I don't need that anymore.
But I will say, as I said when I walked into the studio earlier, I was on the way here and I was a little late because I had to stand in line at the CVS and there was one cashier and there were 10 people in the line and it took me 11 minutes to get through the line. And man, if I could have just walked out of there, had the receipt sent to my phone and have it all work. I mean, there's definitely an appeal. Mm-hmm.
I walked by there the other day, and it's funny. The line was around the block, and there's probably like 150 people waiting to get in there. So
the irony.
Yeah, whatever momentary time savings you would get, you would lose waiting in line. I mean, I think maybe the next generation will be going, I was going to go to Amazon Go, but geez, they only have like 75 sensors, and I can't go to a store with only 75 sensors because it can't handle the crowd.
Who has the time?
Well, to Amazon's point about the tracking and the way you see it on your screen, what I simply do is when I see things that I'm tired of looking at, I go to Amazon and I look at Omega watches because I love to look at Omega watches, and then that's what it shows me every time I go
to
some other website.
That's a good idea. Go look for something that just visually is appealing and calming to you. You'll get that for the rest of your life.
As for Amazon Go, I have to wonder, how many people is it going to take for the average store, not an Amazon store, but the average store, to make that system work? You may have fewer cashiers, but you're going to have a lot of network engineers. If you're a cashier right now, go get your networking certification because they're going to need you 24 hours a day to keep this checkout line free system going.
True. I think that's a really good point. And I think a lot of the hand-wringing about this will be that pretty similar to what happened when automated registers came in where you can self-check. I personally think that those are sometimes more of a pain than they're worth, but there was a lot of hand-wringing about labor and how this is going to eliminate cashiers. And the fact is, it will eliminate cashiers. And I think that speaks to this much larger issue that our whole country is facing, that every industry is facing, from grocery stores to journalism, frankly, about automation and how are we going to deal with that. And, and I'll say the current administration is sort of sticking its head in the sand on that issue and saying, well, we'll just bring all the coal jobs back. We'll just bring all the manufacturing jobs back. They're not coming back. And so to Essex's point, I mean, it is, what we need is an investment in training people to do jobs that support that system that's coming. And I don't know how many people it's going to ultimately take to maintain those systems. Probably not as many as you're suggesting over time. But I think this feels like, if it's not the future, this is some version of the future.
Well, won't people, students, even government, if the situation, the job loss gets serious enough, won't we move toward the jobs that exist? Won't we just have to? The dystopian future, I can't tell how worried I should be about that.
I'm not trained to be a network engineer or
anything. But you could be.
I could be, but we don't have a system right now that is in place, and it needs to be in place now for what's already happening to get, more and more and more extreme, because we just cannot factor or assume that we're going to have a 20th century style economy and a 20th century style workforce in the 21st century. We're not going back. And so we need to start that now. And right now, automation is like the magic dirty word that Donald Trump won't say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I fear that we're actually going in the opposite direction.
Maybe it'll be a good thing that if we reduce the number, we won't absolutely eliminate certain categories of jobs, but if we reduce the kind of crappy, dangerous jobs, maybe that will be a good thing. And I, you know, no, don't mean to diss people who work in convenience stores, but it's probably not what they, you know, graduated from high school wanting to do. And so, you know, if there are places that we can kind of take some of the friction out of the process and give people opportunities to do other things, maybe that might be a good thing.
Just wait until we get the self-driving FedEx and UPS delivery trucks. Imagine how many jobs are at risk there.
Right. Final note on Amazon Go. A CNBC tech reporter said that they, you know, 'cause the national reporters came to Seattle, right, to do that story, to do the I did the shopping experience. And she says that they missed her yogurt. And Amazon said, we don't care. This is going to be so rare. Don't even bother telling us about it. Enjoy your free yogurt.
Well, just think about the loss prevention departments that conventional supermarkets,
yes,
and, you know, and Nordstrom and everywhere have. I mean, if you can get a system that's basically foolproof and you just sort of have a percentage that you don't worry about, I mean, it's going to save the money.
All right. Well, if you're in a hurry, it sounds like don't bother going to Belltown because there are lines to get into the time-saving Amazon Go store. That's Erica C. Barnett, Briar Dudley, Essex Porter. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to come right back and continue the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. Briar Dudley is with the Seattle Times editorial board. Erica C. Barnett with the C is for crank.com. Essex Porter, reporter at Cairo 7 News. And I'm Bill Radke. This week, a Michigan judge sentenced a former athletic team doctor to 40 to 175 years in prison. Larry Nassar pleaded guilty to sexually abusing 7 girls. He's been accused of molesting many, many more, with victims as young as 6 years old. Nassar most famously treated Olympic gymnasts, but he treated many other people as a Michigan State University physician. Dozens of young women and girls he molested came to his sentencing hearing to confront him.
And while we all are moving mountains, you, Larry, will have no choice but to sit in prison and wait to die.
This trial and sentencing felt monumental, especially combined with the Me Too movement. It felt like a societal shift. Erica, how momentous do you think this is and will prove to be?
I think it's huge. And I think part of that is the fact that the judge did allow anyone who wanted to speak about their trauma, about their experience, and about how they felt about the sentencing. I think it was 150 young women mm-hmm. came and were able to address Nassar directly. And I think that that really does remove some of the stigma that victims of sexual assault and sexual violence often feel, to be able to have that catharsis and have that public recounting. I think it, you know, maybe makes people who think that this is rare or that this sort of thing doesn't really happen or that women and girls exaggerate, think again and start to maybe believe women when they say something has happened to them. That's my hope anyway. I've seen quite a bit of backlash to the way the judge treated the trial and the fact that she, you know, was absolutely contemptuous of Nassar's, you know, absolutely contemptible behavior.
You mind if I play just a moment of that? This
sure.
is the judge, Rosemary Aquilina. Yes, contemptuous is a good word. And I think the people who say that maybe she went too far were pointing to comments like this one.
Our Constitution does not allow for cruel and unusual punishment. If it did, I have to say, I might allow what he did to all of these beautiful souls, these young women in their childhood. I would allow someone, or many people, to do to him what he did to others.
So you were saying, Erica, your reaction to that and the, as you said, backlash?
I think that that reaction on the judge's behalf is absolutely in line with what he did. I mean, the harm that he caused these girls, and they were girls when he molested and assaulted them, is unfathomable. And to state, not to levy a cruel or unusual punishment, but to state that, you know, that unfathomable harm deserves unfathomable punishment is perfectly in line with the crime, in my opinion. And, you know, frankly, when Dennis Hastert was convicted and the judge went on for
the former Speaker of the House.
Correct. He was convicted of molesting some young men. And the judge, a man, gave a statement that went on for 47 pages. I didn't see an awful lot of backlash to his contempt for that. And I'm seeing a lot more to this judge's.
You know, when you listen to the young women and then you hear the judge, what I was thinking was, just as someone who's listening to these young women, you're happy to have a judge speak for us, because so many of us felt the same way. And she just said what America was thinking. And I don't think she did any harm to the case.
Well, I don't know. I think that there's a time for her to express that, though. And, I think it was great that she let all those women speak. That was fantastic. It was very cathartic. It was timely. It was really what that guy deserved. He's horrible. But maybe by saying that right when she did, she might have crossed a little bit of a line, and it's too bad. It's hard, but judges have to be held to a higher standard, and she can express the thing about, geez, maybe we should have you gang raped. That's just, that's maybe not quite, that was kind of a sour note for me at the end of what otherwise was really a remarkable performance.
And I think, and I'm not responding directly, specifically to your response, Breyer, but just in general, there's been a lot of remarking from men, primarily on Twitter and in think pieces and, all over the internet, about how inappropriate it was for this judge to step out of line because she should be held to a higher standard of impartiality. I think the standard, well, first of all, I mention again the Dennis Hastert case, which had a male judge, and there was not a similar blowback. I think that it has entirely to do, or largely to do, with the fact that she's a woman, and there's a lot of men who don't like women speaking out of place. But I also think that impartiality in this case is impossible. I mean, it's impossible not to be partial on a guy who molested and ruined the lives of hundreds of women and girls. I don't think impartiality. I think impartiality would be inappropriate in this case. And
well, is it impartial? I think isn't the case that these girls and young women got to tell their stories and express how it made them feel, and some of them said, "I hate you." I mean, that's their story. But that these critics wanted the judge to express her partiality with the sentence, and not with the suggestion of gang raping a defendant.
Well, I would say that she didn't actually suggest
that. She didn't use the words.
That.
She talked. Someone or many people.
Well,
do that. I want to let Erica finish, because I inserted myself into this, what you're saying.
I think that what she said was not only entirely appropriate, I think it's in line with what other judges have said in cases of this magnitude and this level of publicity. And I think she is being held to a different standard.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't talked to lawyers or judges about this. I need to know more about the timing of her comment and how that might affect a possible appeal. I sure hope to heck that by inserting that one comment when she did, that she does not open the door for that, bastard to have his sentence reduced. That's a concern. That's the kind of thing that the judge needs to do to be sure that she can express herself at the right time and she doesn't compromise the sentencing. And I don't know enough about it to say that, okay. But that's something I think we need to know more about.
Well, larger than that one and a couple more comments, any ideas what we could do to prevent this? Because right now there are how many, young gymnasts and dancers and basketball players and people who are trusting that they're dedicated to what they're doing, and they're trusting this authority figure, and so much feels at stake to them. What else can we do so this is happening less?
I think the first thing we can do is create a culture of consent, and that starts, and I'm talking about just consent in general. You don't have to teach preschoolers about sex. You don't have to teach them too much about inappropriate touching, you know, nothing that's not age appropriate. But I think that, you know, if we start teaching children that, you know, and especially girls, but boys, how to behave in a way that requests consent, that understands when things are inappropriate, then that would go a long way. I mean, right now in preschools, we start, I was just reading a study about this, the way that we start sort of instilling, you know, the standard gender roles among boys and girls, and that it's okay for boys to, you know, to touch girls. And I think we have to start there, because and that's on the side of the victims, of course. But I think that it's also on the side of the perpetrators if we teach boys in particular that, you know, crossing boundaries is not OK, and that people have the right to set boundaries. That's where I would start.
And maybe, you know, one thing I've seen is a suggestion that, you know, when you're at the big family gatherings, you know, the grand auntie always wants to hug all the kids, and some of the kids want to be hugged and some of them don't. And maybe one way of teaching this is, to, you know, to teach the kids and to prevail on the grand auntie. If someone doesn't want to hug, you're not allowed to hug them. And if you don't want someone to hug you, they're supposed to respect that. And building that with very young children builds the idea that consent is necessary on both sides.
But this is at another level with this doctor saying, oh, her hips and spine are out of alignment, which puts her pelvic bone out of alignment, and this is my therapy. And so you have this situation of it's a trusted doctor, and then you have the situation of parents, gymnasts coming to authorities and saying, this is happening. And we've seen just this morning, the athletic director of Michigan State stepped down. Earlier this week, the president stepped down. But there was a lot of voicing saying this isn't okay, and a lot of people invested in the athletic system just shunting off their complaints.
Well, I think the thing about consent that Essex and I were talking about is that when you instill that in people, they understand when behavior is inappropriate and they feel more empowered to speak up about it. Mm-hmm. But I also think on the flip side of things, there need to be a lot of firings and a lot of very public denouncements, which gets back to the judge, of this kind of behavior. And there need to be consequences, because consequences make people not engage in those behaviors, because if they know they're going to get caught and punished.
Well, sadly, there's always going to be horrible people. I'm hoping that we've turned a corner here somehow towards more empowerment, and whether it's through learning the consent language and things like that. But you know, the remarkable trial we just had, and the publicity it's received, and the conversations it sparked in families, and you know, everybody in gymnastics is now having that conversation, for instance. Whereas, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, you know, before the Indy Star got that tip and chased this story down, could you imagine having that conversation?
That's the newspaper. Those are the journalists at the Indianapolis Star.
Yes.
So, a reminder of the incredible importance of local reporting.
Yes. On the Weekend Review, we just have enough time at the end of our show here to turn to, there is a happy aspect of sports that we're going to, is the ending note we get to sound in just a moment when we come back in the Weekend Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We have Briar Dudley here and Erica C. Barnett and Essex Porter. Edgar Martinez, not in the Baseball Hall of Fame again. This week, the Baseball Writers Association of America, for the ninth time, decided Edgar wasn't good enough, even though that same organization every year gives an award to the outstanding designated hitter in the American League, and it's called the Edgar Martinez Award. Anyone boiling about that?
I see no boil. I'm not boiling about it. I met Edgar Martinez very briefly once. What a gracious person.
Yep.
It is an injustice that it's taken so long, and it had better be rectified next year.
He's got one more chance. You can be on the ballot 10 times, and most people are saying Edgar's in at the last possible moment a year from now. Finally, how about the Seattle hockey team? We don't know for sure, but we'll find out soon whether an NHL team is coming here. We think one will. That's why we're renovating Key Arena. This week, we found out the company trying to bring a team here has registered possible internet domain names, including the Seattle Cougars, Eagles, Emeralds, Evergreens, Firebirds, Rainiers, Renegades, Sea Lions, Seals, Sockeyes, Totems, Whales, and the Seattle Kraken. Any vote?
It sounds like a junior high soccer league.
Yes.
Why don't they go to the Metropolitans?
Yes, Metropolitans.
That's the form. That was the Seattle NHL team, right? Yes. NHL at the time, was it called NHL? A former pro hockey team years, right. Decades ago.
What is the mascot for a Metropolitan?
It's history is the mascot.
Building?
Remember, they were the first North America. They were the first U.S. team to win the Stanley Cup.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember Essex. I don't.
Okay, what's better, Erica?
Well, I think, you know, you need to have something, just something that sounds like a building is not good, something that sounds like a forest is not good. These are stationary objects. I've been to one hockey game, so I believe I'm an expert when I say it moves very fast.
It's not so stationary as a building.
Not so stationary as a building. So I think something that moves fast. I was thinking the Schooners.
Yeah, the Schooners.
The Gold Rush.
The Gold Rush.
You know, we haven't really, we have a Gold Rush Museum here. We haven't really capitalized
on that. The
Klondikes. The Klondikes. Yeah. I like the Klondikes.
I talked to someone today from Vancouver, BC, which would be Seattle's rival, who said since the Canucks, the Vancouver Canucks, have an orca as a logo, Seattle needs to have something that threatens an orca. So maybe the Seattle climate change, the Seattle salmon shortage. So there's still time. There's still time to weigh in. We'll see if we even get a team. Right now, our team is Essex Porter from Cairo 7 News, reporter there. Erica C. Barnett covers the city at thecsforcrank.com. Briar Dudley with the Seattle Times editorial board. And I'm Bill Radke. Thank you, team.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Go team. Come again next week.